content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We are reading this week from the February 21st, 2020 issue of The Week magazine. We have quite a busy cover drawing this week. The scene is a car wreck. There are two cars smashed head-on, and in the foreground are Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg, and Bernie is pointing his finger and looks angry at Pete. Pete's standing there with his arms crossed. Joe Biden's leaning out the front window of his car. He also crashed into him. He's got his hand on his head. Amy Klobuchar is standing back there looking on with her hands on her hips. And in the background, there's a stretch limousine, and halfway out the sunroof is Michael Bloomberg with a little smile on his face and his tie blowing in the wind. The title is A Party Divided. Can any of the moderates stop Sanders? And that's our first main story. We'll start right there. The Democrats' fractured field. What happened? The New Hampshire primary left the Democratic Party splintered between its moderate and left wings this week after Senator Bernie Sanders notched a narrow victory over centrist Pete Buttigieg and Senator Amy Klobuchar. Sanders won with nearly 26% of the vote, but that total was the weakest for a New Hampshire victor in party history. Moderates split between Buttigieg, 24.4%, Klobuchar, 19.8%, and Biden, 8.4%. This victory here is the beginning of the end for Donald Trump, a victorious Sanders told a joyful crowd. Former frontrunners Biden and Elizabeth Warren were in deep trouble after finishing fourth and fifth, respectively, and earning no delegates. They also trailed the top three finishers in Iowa. Both, however, vowed to fight on, with Biden departing New Hampshire even before the polls had closed in order to attend a launch party in South Carolina, where he is counting on strong support from the state's African-American community. A Biden advisor confided to Politico.com that the horrendous Iowa and New Hampshire results had demoralized the campaign. "I think we're going to make it to South Carolina," the advisor said, "but I just don't know." Meanwhile, Warren reacted to her lackluster finish with a prediction of a long primary fight. Klobuchar rose on the strength of a vigorous campaigning and a strong debate performance last week, in which she criticized Buttigieg for his lack of experience and President Trump for a complete lack of empathy for working people, barely making their rent. Buttigieg, the 38-year-old former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, followed his first-place finish in Iowa with another strong performance. "We are here to stay," Buttigieg proclaimed as supporters cheered, "President Pete." What the editorial said. New Hampshire results shuffled the deck, said the Republican of Massachusetts. Warren and Biden were big disappointments, and Sanders underperformed in a state he hoped to dominate, while the biggest surprise was Klobuchar. The danger for her and other non-Bernies is that moderates will split the pragmatic voters and enable the 78-year-old Sanders to win with 30-something percent of the vote. Matters will grow only murkier once billionaire Mike Bloomberg officially joins the ballot on Super Tuesday or March 3rd, when 14 states vote. The Democratic primary could be history repeating itself, said the Wall Street Journal. In 2016, Donald Trump capitalized on a large Republican field to seize the nomination with a comparatively small yet fervent base. Now comes Sanders, the socialist from next door, with his similarly unshakable base of millennial and left-wing support. hoping to exploit a divided field. As long as multiple centrist candidates remain, his socialist plurality has the advantage. What the columnist said, "Where the heck has this Amy Klobuchar been for the last year?" asked Megan McArdle in the Washington Post. "Ever since she went toe-to-toe with Brett Kavanaugh during the Supreme Court confirmation hearing, she seemed like the perfect antidote to President Trump. She's a woman, a pragmatist from the Midwest, a funny, warm, and sincere on the stump. But it took until the past week for her to make her case forcefully. The question now is whether she has enough time left to get this done." "Probably not," said Ed Kilgore in NYMag.com. "Both she and Mayor Pete may hit a wall in Nevada and South Carolina, the next two states, because they poured all of their resources into Iowa and New Hampshire. Neither will struggle over the next month to keep up with Sanders' small-dollar donation machines and Bloomberg's billions." Sanders' front-runner status should terrify Americans who believe in liberty and free markets, said Brad Polumbo in WashingtonExaminer.com. "The so-called Democratic Socialist has promised a profound reordering of the American economy that would nationalize health care, heavily regulate most industries, and nearly double federal spending. Even a stubborn Congress can't save the country from his radical agenda. Sanders has already promised to issue a host of executive orders to kickstart a revolution on everything from border security to climate change." "Now that Warren's campaign appears to be over," said John Judas in TalkingPointsMemo.com, "many will point to her waffling on Medicare for All as her fatal mistake. But if you make a timeline of her rise and fall, you'll see instead that her strength accumulated in October after Sanders suffered a heart attack. Once Sanders regained his footing and Buttigieg peeled away some of her educated technocratic supporters, Warren began sinking. Biden's collapse was a disaster for liberalism and the Democratic Party," said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. "For almost a year now, the former vice president commanded the loyalty of Democrats nostalgic for the Obama years, and his popularity stunted the growth of other center-left candidates, including Klobuchar and Senator Cory Booker. Now the sheer disarray of his opposition makes Sanders the favorite, despite his embrace of wildly unpopular policies and a wildly unpopular socialist label. 4 more years of Trump now looms." Second main story, Justice Department bends to Trump in Roger Stone case. What happened? 4 prosecutors withdrew in protest from the Justice Department's case against Trump confidant Roger Stone after President Trump lashed out in defense of his one-time campaign aide and the Justice Department undercut their sentencing recommendations. Stone was convicted last November of lying to Congress about the leak of Russian-hacked Democratic campaign emails and of pressuring a witness to do the same in a case that grew out of Robert Mueller's investigation. The DOJ had initially recommended that Stone serve 7 to 9 years in prison, following federal guidelines. Hours after Trump called that horrible and a miscarriage of justice, top justice officials said they'd been blindsided by the grossly disproportionate recommendation by the prosecutors, and the department cut its recommended sentence down to 3 to 4 years. The House Judiciary Committee has called on Barr to testify in March, and the questioning is expected to include the decision to overrule career prosecutors. The White House denied pressuring the DOJ, but Trump tweeted, "Congratulations to Attorney General Bill Barr for taking charge of a case that was totally out of control." The president also denounced the Mueller scam and the rogue prosecutors who cut and ran by resigning and suggested that the judge in Stone's case, Amy Berman Jackson, is biased against Trump aides. Trump also revoked his nomination of Jesse Liu, a former U.S. attorney who oversaw the Stone prosecution, to a top Treasury Department post. Trump was defiant in the face of criticism, telling reporters he has the absolute right to intervene in Justice Department decisions. What the columnist said. Barr has decided to drop the charade, said Bess Levin in VanityFair.com. He used to go through the motions to look independent. Finally, he's doing Trump's dirty work out in the open. What a weight off his shoulders. There was no legal basis for overriding sentencing guidelines, and the DOJ's own attorneys, said former federal prosecutor Michael Stern in USA Today. Now that Trump has successfully used the Justice Department as a political tool, there's no turning back. Stone, though, may not be worth getting worked up about, said Eddie Scarry in WashingtonExaminer.com. He's a 67-year-old clownish figure who was convicted of being a harmless liar. Two of the prosecutors in this case were disgruntled former deputies of Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller, said Sean Davis in TheFederalist.com. They bullied the DOJ into asking for a 7 to 9 year sentence based on alleged threats that Stone made to a witness who himself insists he never felt threatened. The DOJ was right to back off this excessive demand. The mass resignation suggests there's far more here than a disagreement about Stone's sentence, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. Before his Senate acquittal, Trump had been restrained about flexing his muscles to influence cases. He has yet to pardon any of his convicted campaign aides, including Paul Manafort, but now the president is ready to start bestowing favors on his loyal defenders. This is Trump unleashed and emboldened to put himself ahead of the law. So much for the law and order president. Our controversy of the week goes back to the Democratic primaries. It's titled Bloomberg, the Democrats' best Bernie alternative. Even a few weeks ago, I'd have told you he was wasting his money, said Matt Bai in WashingtonPost.com. But now the prospect of self-funded former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg winning the Democratic presidential nomination no longer seems so remote. Bernie Sanders' victory this week in New Hampshire, following a second-place finish in Iowa, has sent the Democrats' donor class and rank-and-file moderates into full-fledged panic. They are convinced that nominating a self-declared socialist would hand the election to President Trump in November. The apparent collapse of Joe Biden has left the center lane wide open, said Kyle Smith in NationalReview.com. The self-assured, highly accomplished Bloomberg is seen as a more plausible Trump slayer than Pete Buttigieg, with his student council earnestness and thin resume. Amy Klobuchar's campaign, meanwhile, is low on money. Bloomberg has a net worth north of $60 billion and could easily throw $5 billion at the campaign without feeling it. He's already spent more than $300 million on advertising and is building a fearsome national campaign organization of 2,000 well-paid staffers armed with cutting-edge data technology. How poetic it would be if the Democratic race became a showdown between a self-made multi-billionaire and a declared enemy of capitalism. That's the crossroads Democrats seem to be approaching, said Eric Levitz in nymag.com. A morning consult poll finds Bloomberg has risen to third place in the 14 states holding Super Tuesday primaries on March 3rd. Still, since Bloomberg isn't on the ballot until then, Sanders will have a big head start in the delegate count. And could the Vermont Senator have a more perfect foil than a plutocrat literally trying to buy the presidency of the United States? Bloomberg's record as an arrogant, tough-on-crime mayor is just now getting scrutiny, said Elliot Hannon in Slate.com. An audio recording surfaced this week of the then-mayor boasting that cops throwing young black men up against the wall and frisking them had cut crime rates. Based on statistics, Bloomberg added, the police disproportionately stop whites too much and minorities too little. Nonetheless, black voters are warming to Bloomberg, said Christina Greer in the DailyBeast.com. A Quinnipiac poll this week showed him with 22% of black support, topping every Democrat except Biden at 27%. Why? Because African Americans see beating the race-baiting Trump as an urgent priority. As a lifelong New Yorker, Bloomberg isn't afraid to take on the Queens bully currently occupying the Oval Office, said Christopher Suprun in the New York Daily News. Both as a businessman and an elected official, Bloomberg has a record of competence and success that dwarfs Trump's, and both of them know it. Do Democrats really want to replace Trump with another strongman billionaire? Asked Harry Siegel, also in the Daily News. The similarities between the two wealthy egotists are too glaring to ignore. Trump routinely trolls Democrats with kidding, not kidding threats to stay in office after a second term. Bloomberg, as New York mayor, actually did it, using the 2008 financial crisis as a pretext to suspend the city's term limit law. Democrats are rallying to Bloomberg for one reason only, because he has enough money to blow Trump out of the water, said Robert Reich in TheGuardian.com. But desperate times call for desperate measures. If the sociopathic tyrant in the Oval Office can be evicted only by an oligarch like Michael Bloomberg, then we will have to choose the oligarch. It's time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems that it was a good week for fornicators. After Virginia's House of Delegates passed a bill that would repeal the state's ban on sex between unmarried people, thereby providing more credibility to the state's tourism slogan, Virginia is for lovers. It was a good week for teeing off after a University of Missouri study found that playing golf just once a month reduces the risk of premature death by about half, likely because it provides stress relief, the stimulation of competition, and a bit of exercise. And it was a good week for tailwinds after a British Airways passenger jet made the trip from New York to London in slightly less than 5 hours, setting a new record for subsonic aircraft. Assisted by the transatlantic jet stream, the flight arrived 1 hour and 42 minutes early. But it was a bad week for male grooming. After a photograph of a windblown President Trump on the White House lawn showed the graphic contrast between the pale skin at his hairline and the thick orange-bronze makeup on his face. More fake news, tweeted Trump. It was a bad week for the mood of Democrats after 64% of New Hampshire Democrats said in a poll they would prefer that a giant meteor strike the earth, extinguishing all human life, rather than see Trump reelected. And finally, it was a bad week for dialogue. After actor Michael Douglas, whose legendary father, Kirk, died last week at age of 103, told a rally for former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg that in the final moments of his life, his father whispered the words, "Mike can get it done." And a short news piece before we go on. Barr must okay election probes. Attorney General William Barr notified Justice Department officials this week that they cannot open investigations into presidential candidates or their campaigns without his personal approval. The directive follows a report from Inspector General Michael Horowitz, in which Horowitz criticized the FBI for opening a probe into former Trump campaign associate Carter Page. Investigations into Senate and House campaigns and foreign campaign contributions will now require prior consultation with an assistant attorney general. Despite the new rules on investigations linked to political campaigns, Senator Lindsey Graham said this week that the Justice Department is vetting information Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, provided about Hunter Biden's work in Ukraine. We're on the briefing page, going out of the United States for a little while, titled Venezuela in Limbo. Opposition leader Juan Guaido met with President Trump last week. Does he still have a chance of taking power? Why was Guaido in Washington? A year after he swept onto the international stage as the leader of an uprising that could bring democracy to Venezuela, Juan Guaido's star has dimmed. In January 2019, Guaido was the head of the National Assembly, the only democratically elected body remaining in the country after President Nicolas Maduro won a rigged election for a second term. The assembly declared Maduro illegitimate and Guaido, then 35, acting president. He quickly tried to foment a general uprising against the corrupt authoritarian Maduro regime, hoping that the army would come to his side. The U.S. and most Western governments recognized him as Venezuela's rightful leader, but Russia rushed to shore up Maduro's control, and the attempt to overthrow Maduro soon fizzled. Since then, Venezuelan politics have been in a stalemate, with Maduro still fully in charge. Last month, Maduro supporters locked Guaido and his followers out of the parliament, and Guaido launched a two-week world tour in hopes of regaining momentum for his opposition movement, ending his trip in Washington. What did Trump promise? President Trump singled out Guaido as a guest of honor at the State of Union address, calling him the true and legitimate president of Venezuela, leading a righteous struggle for freedom. Trump held up Venezuela's economic collapse as an example of the evils of socialism, a sign that he intends to use the country as a cautionary tale throughout his re-election campaign. Trump administration officials said the U.S. was preparing crippling new sanctions against Maduro's government, but offered no details. The Trump administration has already frozen all Venezuelan government assets, barred transactions with U.S. companies, and enacted an oil embargo. Though aimed at Maduro, those actions furthered the collapse of the Venezuelan economy. The GDP has shrunk a staggering 73% since Maduro took office, and hyperinflation has rendered the Bolivar worthless. But Maduro still has powerful friends, notably, Russia. How is Russia helping Maduro? Russia has supported Venezuela ever since Maduro's predecessor, the late Hugo Chavez, was elected in 1998 to bring old-style socialism to the country. Eager to project power in the United States' own hemisphere, Russia sold some $4 billion worth of weaponry to Venezuela from 2005 to 2008, and began making deep investments in its energy sector. Since Maduro took office in 2013, the Kremlin has propped him up financially and militarily, sending him 36 Russian Su-30 Mk2 fighter jets worth $10 billion. When Maduro seemed at his weakest last spring, Russia sent military advisors and the S-300 surface-to-air missile system to demonstrate that the risks of U.S. military intervention would be high. And when Trump hit Venezuela with sanctions last summer, Russian state oil company Rosneft rescued Maduro by flouting the sanctions and became the main trader of Venezuelan oil, shipping it to buyers in China and India. Russia also made available billions of dollars in loans, and a Russian bank began offering Venezuela's new cryptocurrency, the Petro. How is Venezuela's economy? The Russian infusion of cash, coupled with Maduro's recent abandonment of socialist price controls, has greatly benefited Venezuela's wealthy elite. Caracas, once a scene of empty shelves, gas lines, and mass protests, now bustles with new restaurants and bars and other signs of private enterprise. With Maduro's encouragement, Venezuelans who hoarded U.S. dollars early on are now spending them on imported food, cars, and entertainment. For those who were true believers in Chavez's socialism, which did lift many out of poverty initially, the garish spectacle of extreme inequality is appalling. This is savage capitalism that erases years of struggle, Elias Jua, Chavez's former vice president, told the New York Times. What about outside the capital? Conditions are grim. In smaller towns and cities, government workers, including police, have quit after 4 months without pay. And basic services like water and electricity are spotty or absent. Schools are run by unpaid volunteer teachers. In Parmana, for example, once a prosperous fishing and farming village, nearly all authority figures left, including the priest and the doctor, and the villagers, facing anarchy, were forced to invite Colombian guerrillas in to restore order. Most people who can afford to leave the country have already done so, an exodus of some 4 million. But the UN fears that another 4 million of the desperately poor could join them next year, this year. What's next? Guaido doesn't have much time left to exert a claim on power. The U.S., EU, and Latin American countries recognize him as an interim president because he has a constitutional role as head of the National Assembly. But parliamentary elections are due this year, and since Maduro controls the electoral apparatus and process, his party is sure to win. Latin American leaders are pushing for negotiations that would bring together Maduro and Guaido, along with their respective backers, including Russia and Cuba on one side, and the U.S. and EU on the other. The goal is to allow Maduro a peaceful exit. It's about building a golden bridge, said former Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos, a Nobel Peace Prize winner. For Venezuela, we need a peaceful, negotiated solution with all the stakeholders. It's time to read a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with two from the U.S. The first is titled, The Hidden Economic Crisis. Despite the rosy economic numbers of recent years, said Annie Lowry, many Americans are being bled dry by the spiraling cost of living. Call it the Great Affordability Crisis. Take a close look at where families' money goes, and you can see why in the 2010s, for millions, a roaring economy felt precarious or downright terrible. Housing costs have outstripped wages in roughly 80% of America's metro regions. And even in rural areas, there's been a jump in the number of households spending half or more of their income on housing. Young people simply can't afford to move to areas where the best jobs are. Then there's health care. Soaring premiums, deductibles, and out-of-pocket costs are casting millions into debt. College tuition has skyrocketed, and student loan debt is a $1 trillion stone placed on young adults' backs, with nearly 50 million adults working off debt loads. Finally, child care costs have leaped 2,000% in the past 4 decades, putting a crushing burden on young families. In other wealthy countries, child care and education are public goods, and no one goes bankrupt because they get sick. Until we muster the political will to follow suit, the great affordability crisis hides in plain sight. Decriminalizing drugs doesn't help addicts. Should we decriminalize all drug possession? Asked Jason Rantz. Democratic presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg is the latest progressive politician to adopt that policy prescription, which, in practice, would actually devastate our cities. My city, Seattle, has already decriminalized personal possession of drugs with disastrous results. Yes, jailing addicts doesn't solve the drug crisis, and governments should ensure that anyone who wants drug treatment is able to get it. But if the goal is to reduce drug addiction, decriminalizing possession of such deadly substances as methamphetamine, fentanyl, and heroin doesn't work. In Seattle, overdose deaths have risen significantly since decriminalization. Dealers now operate brazenly in a large open-air drug market in downtown Seattle, knowing that if they carry small amounts, they won't be arrested. Drug use and addiction are rampant in the large, needle-filled encampments of homeless people, some of whom commit crimes to fund their habit. Addicts themselves know they won't see meaningful jail time for buying or carrying, so they have less of an incentive to take up offers of treatment. Decriminalizing drugs is one of the many progressive policies that sound noble but backfire in the real world. This is from the United Kingdom. Fewer kids is the new normal. Which country will be the first to strike a medal for women who produce large families? Asked Janice Turner. Given the frantic efforts of many nations to reverse their plunging birth rates, it's a plausible idea. In Hungary, where fertility is now under 1.5 live births per female, 2.1 births are needed to sustain a population levels, IVF is free, and mothers of four are awarded lifelong exemptions from income tax. Russia, 1.8 live births per female, hands out cash for kids bonuses, but money won't persuade pesky modern women to have more than one kid, if that. They find motherhood boring, expensive, and limiting, and regardless of culture, religion, or race, when women get the chance to have fewer kids, they seize it. Scandinavian countries where families enjoy free preschool and generous parental leave are experiencing the same phenomenon. Birth rates in Sweden, 1.85, Denmark, 1.76, and Iceland, 1.75, are all in decline. Even Catholic countries like Italy, 1.32, and Ireland, 1.8, once fertility powerhouses, have lapsed. Perhaps because the women there remember their grandmothers as worn-out husks at 60. Only poor countries with extreme gender inequality, such as Somalia, 6, or Niger, 6.9, still have booming populations. The rest of us must just accept the fact that ours are shrinking, feel glad that it's good for the environment, and find a way to manage the decline. There's an interesting title to our Last Word article. I didn't pre-read it, so we'll discover together what it's about. The title is A Knack for Finding the Dead. Gene and Sandy Ralston have developed an uncanny skill for locating and recovering the bodies of the drowned, said journalist Doug Horner in The Guardian. Their real goal? Bring closure to the living. When Gene and Sandy Ralston returned to their truck after a day on the Beardsley Reservoir in Northern California in March 2002, they discovered several handwritten notes taped to the doors and windscreen. Call Lieutenant Lunny as soon as you get back to town. It's urgent. The Ralstons, a married couple from rural Idaho, had been scientists until the late 1980s when they began helping out a local search and rescue missions. By the winter of 2002, they had volunteered on more than a dozen searches for victims of drowning across the U.S. and had developed an uncanny ability to find bodies. As the notes instructed, the Ralstons drove to the nearby town of Sonora to meet Lunny. The next mornings, the Ralstons were briefed by FBI agents on a series of kidnappings for ransom that had turned into murders. The families of four victims of abduction had wired more than $1.2 million between them to an account in New York, which they then transferred the money to a bank in Dubai. But the bodies of the victims were now thought to be lying at the bottom of a reservoir just east of Yosemite National Park. To get clear images using their specialized sonar system, Sandy pilots their boat over the area they are searching at no more than 2.5 miles per hour, slower than walking on flat ground. The Ralstons call it mowing the lawn, towing their sonar equipment back and forth through the water, piloting their boat in slow overlapping strips. This was the Ralstons' first homicide case. Typically, a corpse descends through water with its chest facing the surface. When the feet hit the bottom, the knees buckle and the body spills onto its back, arms outstretched. That is the shape the Ralstons usually look for with their sonar. They knew a murder victim would look different, though. We call it packaged, tied up and weighted, Jean said. It took them 2 weeks to find the four murder victims who were, as suspected, lying at the bottom of the New Melones Reservoir. In order to retrieve the bodies, the FBI had to fly in a small, unmanned submarine from the headquarters of its dive team in New York. When the bodies surfaced, agents could see that they had been bound to gym weights with cable ties. An FBI agent and scuba diver named Tony Tyndall was part of the team that met each of the bodies as the sub returned from the bottom. I felt like someone needed to be with them, Tyndall said. They're brought up from their cold, chilly graves all the way to the surface, and now they're ready to tell their story. That story revealed details about the awful way these people died and also hard evidence that directly implicated the perpetrators. Among other things, the same type of cables, ties used to bind the victims' bodies to the weights were found at the home of one of the suspects. Six people were eventually sentenced for their participation in the plot, which included another kidnapping and murder in the autumn of 2001, and two of them are currently on death row. The Ralstons are now in their 70s and spend most of every year traveling to search sites or on the water looking for bodies. They have clocked more than 31,000 miles on their motor home in a single year. In almost two decades of searching, they have found 120 victims of drowning in lakes and rivers across the U.S. and Canada. They are considered among the best underwater search and recovery specialists in North America and have worked for agencies from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police to NASA, hunting for the wreckage of the space shuttle Columbia. When the Ralstons' home phone rings with a search request, though, it is usually a family member of a missing person, someone reaching out after an official search has been called off. By the time the Ralstons arrive at the scene of a disappearance, no one expects the missing person to be found alive. What Jean and Sandy offer is not the hope of rescue, but the solace of finality. They have spent years crisscrossing North America in the service of grief. Drowning is surprisingly silent and swift. People fighting to avoid suffocating in water quickly exhibit what is known as the instinctive drowning response, an involuntary physiological reaction that renders them unable to wave or yell for help. Every part of the bodily system is recruited for a single purpose, to keep the mouth above water. This effort can only be sustained for somewhere between 20 and 60 seconds before a person dips below the surface. The bodies of the drowned sometimes surface on their own, but this depends on the qualities of the water. The putrefaction of flesh produces gases, primarily in the chest and gut, that inflate a corpse like a balloon. In warm, shallow water, decomposition works quickly, surfacing a corpse within 2 or 3 days. But cold water slows the decay, and people who drown in deep lakes, 100 feet or below, may never surface. The weight of the water pins down their bodies. There are scuba divers and underwater cameras, dogs trained to detect the gases released by a body underwater, but none of these are as good at searching large areas or probing deep water, where suspended sediment makes it difficult to see with artificial light. The farthest down the Ralstons have found a body, though, is 570 feet. A 33-year-old man on the floor of Francois Lake in British Columbia. He had been missing for 29 years. Most local authorities will only spend a week or two searching for a drowning victim. Then it is up to the family of the missing person. Some families spend thousands of dollars a day on commercial diving services. Others drag the bottoms of lakes with grappling hooks. Sometimes they chance upon the victim. Often they work until their resources and spirits are spent. Gene and Sandy are anomalies in the world of search and rescue. They pursue this work full-time, but they work for free, only charging travel expenses. A search can go for 10 hours a day and last for weeks. Successful underwater searches also require investigative acumen, and the Ralstons have become seasoned detectives. They are adept at interviewing witnesses and pinpointing search areas using whatever scant evidence is available. Knowing where someone goes under, what search and aid rescue teams call the point of last seen, is often crucial. The rule of thumb, the Ralston said, is that a person will sink to the bottom of a lake within a radius equal to the depth of the water. Occasionally, the Ralstons feel as if they are operating under divine guidance. There have been several times when they lowered their equipment almost directly on top of a body. It happened twice in a single day in 2001 on Hayden Lake in Idaho, where they found the bodies of two men, one who had drowned 19 months earlier and one who had drowned the previous week. It was like picking a page out of a book somewhere and that page having the quote that you want, Gene said. Once on a river in northern Canada, he woke at dawn, raised the curtain on their motorhome window, and spotted the body of a 19-year-old boy in shallow, only 15 feet from shore. That blew our minds, he said. The greatest number of bodies they have found in a single day is four in Idaho's American Falls Lake in August 2010. A man had got into trouble while swimming, and so someone jumped in the water to help. After the second man began to struggle, a third followed, and when he too ended up in distress, in jumped a fourth. All of them drowned. The only body the Ralstons ever found wearing a life jacket was that of a man trying to ride his modified motorcycle at night across Canyon Ferry Lake in Montana. The bike stalled halfway across, and the rider became tangled. He sank with his bike. For the families and friends of the drowned, coping with the loss of a loved one who has drowned without a trace is a special kind of pain. The human brain can't let go unless there is evidence of transformation from life to death, said Pauline Boss, a professor emeritus at the University of Minnesota and a family therapist who has spent the last half century researching what it means to reunite families with the bodies of the deceased. Some people report catching glimpses of their lost loved ones in everyday situations, in the aisles of the supermarket, say, for years after they go missing. You need to see that the person is no longer breathing, Boss said, or you need to see the bones. To add to the cruelties of what Boss calls ambiguous loss, the law, too, struggles to recognize death in the absence of a body. Courts, banks, insurance companies, and creditors need the corpse as proof. That situation freezes the person who is missing. It freezes all of their assets, and it freezes all of their loved ones or anybody else who's depending on them, said Robert Jarvis, a law professor at Shepherd Broad College of Law in Florida. In December 2006, the Ralstons went looking for the body of a young man named Shane Pierce, who had drowned in a boating accident on a Kentucky lake that September. Without a body, Shane's family hadn't been able to get a death certificate. And without a death certificate, they had to continue making the payments for their son's truck and for the mortgage on his house. It almost sunk us, Shane's father, Roger Pierce, told me. The family also couldn't sell the boat. Their son was helming the day he drowned because it was registered in his name. Man, that was tough, Roger said. The boat stood out there in my driveway, and every time I looked at it, I'd think of Shane. At least five different search and rescue groups had tried to find Shane's body before the Ralstons showed up. Gene and Sandy started their search and found Shane in 6 minutes, Pierce said. If I hadn't hooked up with Gene and Sandy, I don't know what would have happened. The Ralstons helped Gina Hugensdorn find find her father, Rick Herron, missing for 15 years. They found his body on the bottom of Wyoming's Flaming Gorge Reservoir in 2012. Hoogendoorn was 18 when her father disappeared, and local officials told her family they would have to get used to the idea of never finding him. She described the feelings of not knowing where her father was, of having nowhere to go to visit and remember him, as an unbelievable hurt. It wasn't until she was 33 when she happened to catch a TV show about a drowning victim whose body was recovered years after they went missing that Hoogendoorn realized she could still try to find her father's body. She looked online and found the Ralstons. She called and described her story to Gene, and he said, "Yep, we'll be down. We'll be down at the end of the week." Once the Ralstons were out on the reservoir, it took them 8 minutes to locate the body. Divers with the sheriff's office did the recovery a month later. They brought him off the boat and set him down, and me and my brother and my mom just loved on him, Hoogendoorn said. The water was deep and cold, so his body was relatively well preserved. He still had form to him, and so I could feel his chest, and it felt like his chest, Hoogendoorn went on. His shoulder felt like a shoulder, and it was very, very surreal to be able to hug him again. It was the most happy, saddest day of my life. We got to find him, then I had to say goodbye again. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in The Guardian. Here's an obituary. The Spartacus star who blazed his own path in Hollywood. Kirk Douglas, 1916 to 2020. With a barrel chest, a chiseled jaw, and a brute intensity, Kirk Douglas did much to define big screen masculinity in the post-war years. The actor who rose from destitution to become one of the biggest stars of any era created something of a rogues gallery in his 87 films, specializing in what he called tough sons of bitches. They included a sadistic New York cop and detective story, 1951, a ruthless Hollywood producer in The Bad and the Beautiful, 1952, and in his most enduring role, the leader of a Roman slave revolt in the epic Spartacus, 1960. His characters weren't all tough guys. One of his most acclaimed performances was as the troubled painter Vincent van Gogh in Lust for Life, 1956. But moral complexity was a consistent theme for Douglas, who once said his work was fueled by anger. "I've always been attracted to characters who are part scoundrel," he said. "I don't find virtue photogenic." He was born Isser Danielovich in Amsterdam, New York, one of seven children of illiterate Russian-Jewish immigrants, said the New York Times. His rag dealer father drank heavily and got into fights, and the family was often left to fend for itself. Young Izzy learned that survival meant hard work. Douglas would hold down some 40 jobs, including as a janitor, gardener, and steelworker, before finding success in Hollywood. After graduating from high school, he worked his way through St. Lawrence University in Canton, New York, then found employment as a professional wrestler while he studied method acting in New York City. There he met the aspiring actress Lauren Bacall and his first wife, Diana Dill, mother of his sons Joel and the actor Michael Douglas. Using the name George Spelvin Jr., he made his Broadway debut in 1941 as a singing Western Union messenger in Spring Again. After 2 years in the Navy in World War II, the newly named Kirk Douglas made his way to Hollywood, said the Washington Post. He landed his first film role on the recommendation of Bacall, then made his breakthrough as a cutthroat prize fighter in 1949's The Champion. His agent objected, considering the movie small time, but Douglas related to a character struggling for respectability and tore off his shirt while auditioning to show his muscles. The movie was a surprise hit, earning Douglas an Oscar nomination. Fed up with being treated as a studio poodle in 1955, he became one of the first actors in post-war Hollywood to establish his own production company, said The Times from UK. He hired little-known director Stanley Kubrick to helm the acclaimed World War I drama Paths of Glory in 1957 and brought him back for Spartacus. Douglas insisted that screenwriter Dalton Trumbo, who had been blacklisted for suspected communist sympathies, appear in that film's credits. When Spartacus became a hit, it effectively killed the Hollywood blacklist. "I think that is the most important thing I've done in my career," said Douglas. A prodigious womanizer, he had affairs with actress Rita Hayworth, Marlena Dietrich, and Ava Gardner. Douglas was described by his first wife as a sexually voracious bird of prey, said the Telegraph. They divorced in 1951, and 3 years later he married producer Ann Boydens. The couple had two sons, producer Peter and actor Eric, and Douglas called the relationship one of Hollywood's happiest marriages. His later years were shaped by a series of traumatic incidents, said the Los Angeles Times. Douglas was injured in a 1991 helicopter crash that left two people dead, and 5 years later suffered a stroke, which damaged his speech and threw him into a deep depression. In 2004, his son Eric died of an accidental drug overdose. Douglas threw himself into philanthropy, building school playgrounds in underprivileged areas, a facility for Alzheimer's patients, and a substance abuse treatment center. Douglas said he gave scant consideration to how he'd be remembered. "When a dog dies, does he go to heaven?" he said. "Nope. You only go around once and just hope you get the brass ring. The rest is ego." And we'll go right on over to the Talking Points page. We've got an article here titled, "Limbaugh, Does He Deserve to Be Honored?" "For 3 decades, Rush Limbaugh has been the voice of conservatism," said Matthew Continetti in NationalReview.com. The shocking diagnosis that he had stage 4 lung cancer and President Trump's decision that last week to award Limbaugh the Presidential Medal of Freedom offer a chance to reflect on his unmatched influence. Limbaugh, 69, is a self-made college dropout who used talk radio to pick up the mantle of GOP thought leader from the Giants, William F. Buckley Jr. and Ronald Reagan. Amassing a weekly audience of 20 million, Limbaugh treated politics mainly as a contest between liberal elites and the American public, entertaining listeners with the irreverent and sometimes scandalous humor of the great shock jocks. A fearless provocateur, he popularized such terms as feminazi and the drive-by media, and inspired a host of conservative radio firebrands and Fox News. "He also made politics vastly more hateful," said Laura McGann in Vox.com. Limbaugh's extremely lucrative brand was built on xenophobic and patently racist populism. His greatest hits include calling law student Sandra Fluke a prostitute for her support of government-funded birth control, mocking feminism as a trick to allow unattractive women access to mainstream society, and mock-quoting then-Chinese President Hu Jintao saying, "Ching Chang Chou Chow." He repeatedly likened black athletes to gang members, called Mexican immigrants an invasion force, popularized a song calling President Obama the Magic Negro, and joined Trump in spreading the birther conspiracy theory that Obama was born in Africa. Past recipients of the Medal of Honor include Mother Teresa, Nelson Mandela, and Elie Wiesel, said Raul Reyes in TheHill.com. "For Trump to put this mean-spirited bully in these great humanitarians' august company is an insult to their memory. Trump owes a lot to Limbaugh, said Jackson Katz in NBCNews.com. In fact, Limbaugh's entire career can be seen as an extended prelude to Trump's presidency. Both are thrice married rich guys who took up the cause of embattled white males. Limbaugh's biggest contribution to Trumpism, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com, was to persuade his ditto heads to only get information from conservative media, because everything else is a lie. Trump's presidency wouldn't be possible without Limbaugh's relentless assault on the very idea of objective truth. Here's a short poll watch piece. 68% of Americans say they are very or extremely motivated to vote this year, while 15% say they are not motivated. And we'll finish today with a quote from a writer that I admire. Hunter S. Thompson, quoted in the New York Times, said, "When the going gets weird, the weird turn pro." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program was generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander and Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138.